Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
You are joining us for episode 12 of our Disney bracket, featuring 1992's Aladdin and 2002's Lilo and Stitch.
We like to have some initial banter to make things more fun, so let's talk about how both these films have issues of racism. Both these films are about non-white cultures, and there's heavy issues of colonial gaze with both of them. We've got some links up on our Facebook that go into it better by not us talking about that. With that disclaimer out of the way, I also just hope everybody joins me in pouring one out for Robin Williams, because, you know, Aladdin.
Yeah. Robin Williams was a terrible loss. Although, I do give Disney props for actually respecting his wishes and not using his unused dialogue in the live-action remake that they're doing.
That is pretty solid. Let's hit summaries before we get too sad. So, in Aladdin, we are in a sort of Arabian Nights-inspired fantasy land of Agrabah, and Street Rat Aladdin falls for a fellow urchin when they're out with some guards. She reveals herself to be the Princess Jasmine, who snuck out of the castle to do some feminism. The obviously evil Jafar informs her that Aladdin has been executed, and she weeps. But in truth, Jafar has spirited him away. Only he can enter the Cave of Wonders and retrieve the magic lamp. Jafar double-crosses him, only for both of them to be buried under the sands. Luckily, the lamp contains a genie. Aladdin tricks him into getting him out, and then wishes to be a prince, so that he will be eligible to marry Jasmine, who can only marry royalty. He promises to use his last wish to free the genie. Jasmine is underwhelmed by him, but as she realizes who he is, she starts to fall for him again. Aladdin attempts to come clean, only for Jafar to grab the lamp and wish himself rulership of Agrabah and, 20 levels of wizard. He subjugates all until Aladdin tricks him into wishing to be a genie for yet more power, but this traps him in a lamp of his own. Aladdin makes good on his promise to free the genie, and the Sultan changes the law so Jasmine can marry as she chooses. The end.
Meanwhile, in Lilo and Stitch, Experiment 626, an illegally genetically engineered entity created by Dr. Jumba Jukiba, has escaped the Galactic Federation convoy escorting him to exile. The Federation tracks his ship to a backwater planet called Earth. The Federation sends their Earth expert, Agent Pleakley, and Jumba to capture the fugitive. Meanwhile, Lilo Pelikai, a disturbed little Hawaiian girl, starts a fight with another kid after being called crazy. Later, Lilo has barricaded herself in her house, preventing her older sister, Nani, from entering. All of this occurring during a check-in with their social worker, Cobra Bubbles. Mr. Bubbles tells Nani she has 3 days to improve, or Lilo will be placed in foster care. After crashing on Kauai, 626 is mistaken for a dog, who Lilo adopts and names Stitch. While initially annoyed, Stitch realizes he can use Lilo as a human shield to avoid capture. While Nani is job hunting, Lilo tries to train Stitch to be a model citizen. Both fail miserably. Nani's friend David tries to cheer them up with surfing, but during a wipeout, Stitch, being too dense to swim, drags Lilo down with him. Mr. Bubbles witnesses this and informs Nani that Lilo will have to be taken away. After days without results, the Grand Councilwoman fires Jumba and Pleakley and enlists Captain Gantu instead. Jumba, no longer restricted by the council, assaults the Pelikai house while Nani is out. By the time she gets back, the house is on fire. While Nani and Bubbles argue, Lilo runs off and she and Stitch are captured by Gantu. Stitch is able to escape and then convinces Jumba and Pleakley to help rescue Lilo. Seeing Stitch has learned the value of family, the Grand Councilwoman allows his exile to be filled on Earth with Lilo. Happy ending.
So these are both really good movies.
Yes. Both are very well remembered. Lilo and Stitch a little less so, although I think that's mostly to do with it not being part of the Renaissance. Although Lilo and Stitch is probably one of the better films to come out from that period.
I think while it's not necessarily widely remembered by the, I guess, general Disney marketing machine, it has a very loyal fan base. Like, I don't think I know anybody who's like, oh, Lilo and Stitch, I didn't like that one. So comparing them is kind of hard, but let's try to get into it, starting with Aladdin.
So Aladdin starts off with Arabian Nights. It's a really catchy song. However, upon initial theatrical release, the lyrics in Arabian Nights were not the best. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, petitioned Disney to change the lyrics, which were originally,
"Where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face."
And they eventually became, "Where it's flat and immense and the heat is intense." And that appeared on the 1993 video release and every single release since. There are still some other problematic lines, like, "It's barbaric, but hey, it's home." It's a damn catchy song. I really wish the lyrics were not racist.
And that's kind of indicative of a lot of Aladdin as a whole. Really catchy, really fun, but there's underlying shittiness in every little bit. Like, Jasmine is ostensibly a feminist icon, but she's a feminist icon from a very white feminist lens.
And she's also very objectified throughout a lot of the film.
A lot of shoulders and belly.
Yeah. It's especially weird juxtaposed with a lot of the others that we see who aren't ostensibly sex workers. Most of them do wear head coverings.
And Jasmine does, but only when she's pretending to be a commoner, more backwards, poor, and that kind of thing. It's messy. Some of Jasmine's agency and independence aspects don't quite fall by the wayside, but they don't all get followed through on in as satisfying a way as it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
It's also still interacting with the whole complicated thing of the Western idea that arranged marriages are evil. Colonial gaze, very complicated. A lot of nuance goes into that. This movie does not unpack at all.
And there's a reason it doesn't really unpack it at all. There is not a single Arab / Middle Eastern / South Asian person in the entire cast or on the production team either.
And I wish that wasn't a thing, because when I wasn't looking at it with a critical eye, when I was just, you know, watching it for the fun, I was like, yes, Jasmine, excellent, give her the lamp. Aladdin and Jasmine have one of the most organically developed relationships in a lot of the things you've seen. They have a lot in common because they're both strongly chaotic good, because they both are trapped by the socioeconomics of their home, and they're both smart and capable and work really well together when they're grifting. And so when they start falling in love, it makes sense. She clearly has a discerning taste. He's the first guy who's treated her like an equal, not like a prize to be won.
I am not a prize to be won!
Yeah, and we get a bit of that with the prince at the beginning of the film, her initial suitor.
"You are born a street rat, you will die a street rat, and only your fleas will mourn you."
And it's heavily implied that he is just the most recent in a long list of failed suitors. You can see how, like, genuine that relationship is when Jasmine finds out about the supposed execution of Aladdin, and she goes through what could probably best be described as survivor's guilt. The fact that she's the princess, and because she was caught with him, that it's her fault that he died. And then she goes to her father and explains the situation, and is for a decent period of time attempting to get justice for a man she believes was wrongly executed.
And Aladdin is, like, ostensibly pretty great. Like, he's handsome, athletic, has a good singing voice, good with kids, knows how to grift, has a pet monkey, and other attractive qualities. But definitely thinks of himself as not being worth anything because of his socioeconomic class. And that's also pretty relatable, this idea that you have no value morally because you have no value currentially.
Financially.
That psychological aspect of him makes him a more complex character than a lot of other Disney princes.
They also do a really great job of writing Aladdin as this very egotistical, older teenager young man. I think one of the best examples of it is after he is captured, he's thrown in the dungeon, he's sitting there in manacles, and rather than trying to figure out how am I going to get out of the royal dungeon, he's there beating himself up. He's like, "That was the princess. I must have looked like an idiot." As a straight guy, I don't think there's anything more relatable than it's like, No, looking dumb in front of a cute girl is the worst thing possible.
Jafar is a lot of fun.
Jafar is a super campy villain.
The Disney Renaissance gave us probably some of the best Disney villains, and Jafar is so much fun. He oozes sinister, and because he has this magic hypnosis staff, he can just do whatever he wants and get away with it.
Many of the main characters in the film have sidekicks, and a lot of times they're there so that they have someone to play off of if they're in a scene effectively alone. So Aladdin has Abu, Jasmine has Raja, Jafar has Iago.
Oh, Iago.
I think the decision to cast Gilbert Gottfried as Iago was excellent. Having that grating voice on this evil lackey character who does most of the physical comedy. But what's really interesting about Jafar and Iago's relationship is that it's much less one-sided than a lot of similar relationships in Disney. There's specifically a scene where Iago has the idea, well, Jasmine can't kick you out when she becomes queen if you're Sultan because you married her.
What if you were the chump husband?
What?
And typically what a normal Disney villain would do is berate their lackey, that's a terrible idea, reword it slightly, and present it as their own idea. But not only does Jafar not take credit for that idea, but he specifically, it's like,
I love the way your foul little mind works.
And it's this really interesting dynamic that we don't get to see in other Disney villains, like with Ursula and her eels, or Scar and his hyenas.
Jafar is also really misogynist.
Yeah. You can see it a lot in how he treats Jasmine towards the beginning of the film, and it comes out in full force in Act 5, where she's in the slave girl outfit, waiting on him hand and foot, and then gets even creepier when he tries to use his final wish to seduce her. Like, doing that is a good way to differentiate Jafar from Aladdin, who throughout most of the film does not necessarily underestimate Jasmine. At the beginning, when they first meet, he just tells her, play along, and trusts that they'll be able to get out of this fine.
It's interesting that Jafar and Aladdin are so different in how they interact with women. They both have similar goals, almost, but different ways of going about them. They both want agency, but for Aladdin, that just means freedom to not have to worry about stealing for food. For Jafar, it's wanting more power, more power, more power. But because they both have this desire for more in different ways, it lets them kind of play off each other really well.
Yeah, I think the best example of this is the very climax of the film where Jafar is turned into a cobra. He's kind of taunting him, you know, it's like,
without the G-boy, you're nothing.
And that's always been Aladdin's biggest hang-up, is feeling worthless because he's poor. And then he has an idea, and he also knows what Jafar's biggest hang-up is, and it's like, that there's going to be someone more powerful than him. And he points it out, it's like,
the genie has more power than you'll ever have.
What?
He gave you your power. He could take it away.
Al, what are you doing? Why are you bringing me into this?
Face it, Jafar. You're still just second best.
To, you know, taunt Jafar into wishing himself into a genie, which Aladdin knows has a binding clause.
It's a fun fly too close to the sun type thing.
I will give them credit for not using the staff during the climax of the film where he is attempting to seduce Jasmine.
Yeah, that could have been really icky.
Yes.
There's complicated stuff with Jasmine using her sexuality to distract him, but it could have been a lot more squeaky. On that note, I appreciate that the genie can't make somebody fall in love. That's a really good rule for them to have.
Speaking of genie, Robin Williams is on his A-game here. It's a joke a minute. Most of them land. I will admit a lot of the celebrity impressions are a bit dated.
Like Jack Nicholson and Rodney Dangerfield.
I doubt many younger viewers would be able to identify those people. And even I, who was a little young when this film came out to actually watch it, even I was unfamiliar with a few of the cameos until I looked up who exactly they were.
It doesn't bother me too much because, like you said, it's a joke a minute. So even if you don't get one, it just breezes right past it to the next one. And that's a really good way to do comedy. According to my research, they just put Robin Williams in a recording booth and told him to go and then animated around that, which is exactly what you should do with Robin Williams. And Genie as a character is an interesting shift for the film because for the most part, it's a pretty straightforward high fantasy thing. And then Genie shows up and it becomes way more meta.
They don't necessarily break the fourth wall, but they kind of pretend that it's a pane of glass. There are some issues with Genie, though, because we're dealing with a narrative that is ostensibly about a enslaved individual who is rather jovial, happy, there for entertainment, and is helping out a bumbling protagonist. There's a solid argument that Genie is a magical Negro trope, and that's not even getting into all the icky stuff with just enslavement as part of the narrative.
It could be a lot worse. I mean, Genie does get his freedom at the end, but his freedom is reliant on him kind of being a good servant. So it's a little weird. We talked about how Jasmine and Aladdin have a really good relationship, and that's important. It's well written, all that jazz. I don't believe the relationship between Genie and Aladdin as much. It's there. They have some good dialogue, but because Genie doesn't show up until the second act and they're kind of separated in the fourth act, they don't really build that relationship that much. And when they do, it's Genie either trying to help Aladdin get the girl or trying to get Aladdin to set him free. And there's not a lot of time spent just developing them as collaborators and conspirators. And they have this whole like hug at the end and like, oh, you're my best friend thing. And I don't really buy it.
That's fair. I think a lot of the reason that they weren't able to explore that relationship more is because due to circumstances, Aladdin has to keep Genie a secret from everyone he's interacting with as soon as he gets to the palace in Agrabah. So we've talked a lot about Robin Williams and the humor he brings to the film, but it's not just him. There are some other jokes that do really well. Aladdin has some really great comedic moments. There's the whole scene where he grifts Genie into getting a free wish to get him out of the collapsed cave. There's this great Gilligan cut where Aladdin is fleeing from the guards and one of the townsfolk's like,
getting into trouble a little early today, aren't we, Aladdin?
Hey, Aladdin's like, you're only in trouble if I get caught. The guards then immediately show up, gotcha. And it just,
I'm in trouble. And the Sultan used to have a lot of fun too. He's a sort of sweet, bumbling old Santa Claus-y man.
Mm.
And he's very clearly weak-willed, which allows Jafar to do a lot of wicked things, but even he isn't sure about this whole old clause in the law that says that the royal vizier should marry the princess, when he's like,
but you're so old.
And then there's the whole scene where the Sultan, Ali, and Jafar are all arguing about, like, whether or not Jasmine should marry this person, and Jasmine just walks in and is like, what the hell are you all doing?
Please tell me, what do the menfolk think?
So, there's almost two layers to this film. You've got Jasmine, Aladdin, Jafar, and the Sultan. Right below that, you've got Abu and Iago and Genie, who are a little more self-aware, a little more comical, and they're in almost every scene, so they're bringing the comedy to keep the energy up while the plot is happening, so you're not bored while they're talking about complicated legal things and who's in what position of power and who knows what about the other, etc. Which means you get to have, like, human characters doing serious things and the non-human characters having commentary on it.
I'm going to point out that you missed Raja and Carpet.
Oh yeah, Raja and Carpet. Carpet.
Carpet is one of the few elements of this film that is CG.
And the Cave of Wonders.
Yeah, and a vast majority of the exterior interior of the Cave of Wonders. Carpet, it's not so bad. I will admit there's a few points where Carpet is kind of like captured and getting tied up and stretched, where the texture on the model looks pretty bad. But for the most part, because Carpet is effectively two-dimensional, the CGI isn't too bad. The Cave of Wonders, unfortunately, is pretty bad. The flight scene as the cave is collapsing has a almost entirely CG background between the lava and the cave walls, and it looks like some bad VR game from the early 90s.
Which is a pity because the rest of the film's animation is really good. We paused at one point, you can see the lines had different widths, and that kind of gives it this very active, energized feeling.
We get a lot of action scenes throughout the film. We have the song that introduces Aladdin, where he is jumping around, evading the guards. There's a little bit of sword fighting. We have the whole new world montage, where we're getting these loop-de-loops and barrel rolls and all that sort of stuff. They're flying over water and you can see the ripple effects. And then there's the fight scene at the climax of the film that has all this magic going around everywhere. There's some really well animated action scenes that really stand out. We've talked a lot about Aladdin. We should go ahead and hit Lilo and Stitch.
Yeah. Ooh. I didn't remember how much this movie hurts you.
I remember watching this film a few years ago as an adult, and I was shocked at how much I did not pick up on when I was watching as a child. Lilo is very, very disturbed. And as you're able to put the pieces together through the film, it keeps getting sadder and sadder. When we first meet Lilo, she's talking about having to go feed Pudge the fish. Everyone's confused why this is so important, and she's like,
Pudge controls the weather.
The film never explains this, but later on, she tells Stitch about what happened to their parents, that they were driving and it was raining. You can kind of assume that they were in a car accident because of the rainy roads. That's why it's so important that she feed Pudge. If he controls the weather, then she can prevent that from happening again and losing Nani or anyone else she cares about.
This is a child who is having these worries. The problems in Aladdin are grand kingdoms and magic and stuff. With Lilo and Stitch, the big conflict is this family might be separated. This girl might have to go to a foster home, which is ostensibly a very small conflict, but because of the emotional torque they put into it, it is functionally almost as bad as losing all of Agrabah to an evil sorcerer. The song Nani singing to Lilo the night before she's probably going to be taken away is the same song that the last queen of Hawaii sung to her people before Hawaii was absorbed into the American Empire. And it's a very literal, you are my whole world that I am losing.
Whereas no one on the Aladdin team did that in-depth research. In Lilo and Stitch, it definitely shows. They don't get everything right, and there is the inherent problem that is this is a huge multinational corporation using this culture to profit from. But they handle the culture and showing it in a more holistic sense than Aladdin does, especially if you get into some of the deleted scenes from the film where they go more heavy into the colonial gaze with the tourists of the Hawaiian Islands. You can see a little bit of it with all of the tourists that Lilo has taken pictures of on the wall and kind of turning that relationship on its head. But there's a deleted scene where Lilo is letting all the tourists know about a tsunami siren that she knows is going to be tested in the next few minutes. But doesn't mention that it's a test.
Lilo has a wicked sense of humor.
This incorporates a more diverse cast than Aladdin. We have Nani and David, who are both played by actors with Pacific Islander heritage. Unfortunately, that doesn't also apply to Lilo, whose actress is white. However, they went with a different direction. This is also the actress who played Donnie Darko's little sister, as well as the girl in the Ring movies.
Samara. There's a lot to talk about with Lilo and Nani and David, but I want to at least give some lip service to the space stuff. The space stuff starts us out for about 10 or 15 minutes, then we go down to Earth and focus on those problems, and I found myself going, oh god, can we please go back to the space stuff? I'm so sad now. Because the space stuff is a lighthearted comedy fare. Dr. Jumba, who prefers to be called Evil Genius, is a delight. Agent Bleakley and the rest of the council are these very fun, exaggerated characters. All the space designs are great. They all kind of have this very aquatic feeling, which works really well when we went to Hawaii. And water is constantly surrounding both the characters and their culture, so it feels very harmonious.
Honestly, the water animations in the film are excellent as well. This is probably second only to Moana.
Which is slightly unfair, because you know, Moana has kind of water as it's kind of a plot point.
Yeah.
It comes up once or twice.
It's literally a character.
Although I won't deny that because I just saw Jurassic World, I kept expecting there to be like a mosasaur in those waves. There was not. There's, however, David in those waves. He is the most dateable Disney man. Fight me.
David is great. So throughout most of the film, Nani is just constantly trying to keep her head above water. She has taken over being a parent for Lilo after the sudden death of her parents. She's trying to maintain the household, hold down a job, make sure Lilo is dealing with that grief well, and she's stretched too thin everywhere. And David is obviously very interested in pursuing a relationship with her, and he kind of checks in with her every once in a while, and she would like to pursue that relationship, but she's like, I don't have the time. And David's like, no, I get it. But if you need any help, let me know.
Speaking of Nani, though, gosh dang, the adultness and the nuance of Nani as a character is so much that I'm shocked to find this in a Disney animated classic type film. Her fear at losing Lilo juxtaposed with her anger at the stresses that Lilo brings because of who Lilo is are fascinating and layered and really well acted.
Yeah, we get this odd for Disney relationship dynamic where we have a screaming match between the two of them for pretty much the first interactions that we see with the two of them on screen. As soon as Cobra Bubbles leaves, they're just at each other's throats. It shows you how much stress these two individuals are under and how not well they're dealing with the death of their parents.
While obviously, you know, you want families to be together and there's that shitty thing of Indigenous families being separated, I kind of see where Bubbles is coming from with the whole Lilo needs a better house, because Nani really is barely holding it together. It's shitty, but he's not entirely unreasonable as a person. I mean, obviously there's better ways to solve the problem, but with what he has available to him.
But it's also really interesting. So the film starts out, we get the introduction of Stitch, we get the title sequence, and then we get the introduction of Lilo. And how those two narratives overlap with each other is incredibly interesting. In both of those scenes, Stitch and Lilo respectively are called abominations. They also both bite someone, and then that person asks, does this look infected to you?
Does this look infected to you?
Yeah. It's incredibly subtle, but it works to show you that Lilo and Stitch are both having this parallel journey throughout the film. So we have been showering this film with quite a bit of praise. I do want to point out some flaws in the film. Because we're having to balance this very small family narrative about trying to prevent Lilo from being taken to foster care, as well as all of the intergalactic intrigue with this like fugitive on the run, the narrative towards the middle just gets really unfocused. I think if they did a better job of stitching the two narratives together sooner, then they wouldn't have had some of those problems.
It doesn't help that there's essentially three different space factions who are all working kind of together, kind of separately. And that means there's like three different people trying to capture Stitch towards the end of the film. I think if you rolled the Councilwoman and Gansu into one person, it would have streamlined the plot a little bit more, given a little bit more room for things to breathe that needed it.
Yeah, especially since you have to balance them with the antagonists for Lilo's narrative, which are ostensibly Cobra Bubbles and, to a certain extent, Stitch.
I forgot that Lilo and Stitch have that falling out where Lilo displaced a lot of her problems onto Stitch, because that is an easier solution than things are bad.
It makes the problems concrete, like this is the source of them and I can kind of project it onto, and if I get rid of that, then the problems will go away. So yeah, we effectively have five different antagonists throughout the film. This one's also relatively minor, but it bugged the crap out of me. The animators cannot decide on how big Jumba's head should be. There are some times where Jumba's head takes up about the same amount of space as his torso, and there are some times where it's much more in line with human proportions. And it just varies wildly back and forth throughout the film, and it's a little jarring.
I'm not sure if it's a problem or not. So for a good chunk of the movie, Dr. Jumba and Agent Bleakley are disguised as humans. Badly, but it's a cartoon, so no one notices. Mm-hmm. And Bleakley often wears ostensibly women's clothing, despite being, as far as we can tell, a male character. Like, you know, a lot of dresses, wigs, I think makeup at one point. And I don't know how I feel about the issues of gender and gender performativity in here, because there's so much else happening in this film, and because these characters also have other traits as well as like that. There's not really a lot of data to have a good thesis on that, and aliens wouldn't necessarily know what 21st century Earth gender norms are.
Well, Pleakley should. He's the Earth expert.
Pleakley thinks that mosquitoes are an endangered species.
Fair enough.
He's an expert in the same way that I am a whale expert, having read Moby Dick once, and I think I saw the Free Willy movies as a kid. I'd love to see that explored more thoroughly.
It is interesting that they went with a more odd couple dynamic between Jumba and Pleakley, as opposed to a buddy cop dynamic, which would have easily fit the situation.
For sure.
It's also interesting, this film very rarely feels like a Disney film. When we get the musical montages, it definitely feels like that. Hawaiian Roller Coaster Ride is a excellent song. The children's chorus just makes it. But with some of the darker, more complex themes that the film is exploring, with Lilo specifically, this feels closer to like a Tim Burton film or like something akin to Coraline or Paranorman.
That said, this is during the experimental period, and it does share a lot of common themes and visuals and even genres with Treasure Planet, which is also a fairly dark, fairly not that Disney-like movie.
Probably another part of the explanation for that feeling that we get here is that this was designed as a much more low-budget film for Disney, so it didn't get nearly the amount of executive scrutiny that larger projects do. They also drastically changed the house style for this film, as opposed to using the normal gouache background painting techniques that were common throughout all of the Renaissance. They went to watercolor, and while the watercolors are very reminiscent of older Disney fare like Cinderella and Dumbo, here, because of the vibrance of them, it doesn't really match that style either.
Watercolors, great choice for this. For obvious reasons. Also with the animation, the bodies are very varied. You have characters who are thin or fat or everything in between, and it's really cool. Like, they feel like actual people and not cartoons.
We actually see at the very beginning in Lilo's hula class, the older women who are dancing, they actually have like muffin tops over their hula skirts. Lilo takes pictures of tourists who are fat and has a wall dedicated to them into the room, and she specifically comments about how beautiful she thinks they are. This movie does a really good job of having a lot of body diversity.
Also, people have noses, and those noses have width.
They are not your typical Disney button nose.
Talked a bit about Nani before, but there's a bit when they're trying to rescue Stitch because he's sinking because he's too dense, and Nani just kicks him off with, one assumes, the mentality of, he can drown, I'm saving my sister, which is really dark, and it goes by pretty fast, you might not notice it, but gosh dang, like, that's a dark thing for a protagonist in a Disney movie to do.
It also, once again, highlights how much of a good person David is, because he realizes Stitch isn't there, and he goes back down after to try and save him. Alright, we have talked quite a bit about both of these films. It's probably time to make a decision.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Lilo and Stitch. I think Lilo and Stitch aims higher and I think achieves higher.
Ignoring all of the problematic racial stuff of both of these films, I think that Aladdin is structurally a better film. However, Lilo and Stitch takes a lot of risks. And a lot of those times, those risks pay off. The narrative can get a little muddy and messy, but I felt so many more emotional highs in Lilo and Stitch than I did in Aladdin. So my vote is for Lilo and Stitch as well.
Oof. Going in, that was, we thought this was going to be a lot harder than it was. Lilo and Stitch wound up being really, really emotionally evocative. But what's up next week?
Next week, we are heading into the last quarter of round one, starting off with The Lion King versus Oliver and Company. So we're going to be dealing with lots of talking animals next week. Once again, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. We'll hope to see you next time.
Yeah. Like, share, subscribe, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and tell your friends.
Mm-hmm. Also, to our Ukrainian listener who has been very diligent in listening to our content and is about 6.5% of our total listens, we see you. Thank you very much.